He only took on board 3 passengers. Seems like a special sort of deal to me. No running jump required there. I don't remember, DeWitt said again. Reacher just looked at him quietly. DeWitt stared back. How should I remember? I hear about something for the first time in 30 years, and I'm supposed to remember every damn detail about it? This isn't the first time in 30 years. You were asked all about it a couple of months ago. In April of this year. DeWitt was silent. General Garber called the NPRC about Hobie, Reacher said. It's inconceivable he didn't call you afterward. Won't you tell us what you told him? DeWitt smiled. I told him I didn't remember. There was silence again, distant rotor blades coming closer. On behalf of his folks, won't you tell us? Jody asked softly. They're still grieving for him. They need to know about it. DeWitt shook his head. I can't. Can't or won't? Reacher asked. DeWitt stood up slowly and walked to the window. He was a short man. He stood in the light of the sun and squinted left, across to where he could see the helicopter he could hear, coming in to land on the field. It's classified information, he said. I'm not allowed to make any comment, and I'm not going to. Garber asked me, and I told him the same thing. No comment. But I hinted he should maybe look closer to home, and I'll advise you to do the exact same thing, Mr. Reacher. Look closer to home. Closer to home? DeWitt put his back to the window. Did you see Kaplan's jacket? His co-pilot. DeWitt nodded. Did you read his last but one mission? Reacher shook his head. You should have, DeWitt said. Sloppy work from somebody who was once an MP major. But don't tell anybody I suggested it, because I'll deny it and they'll believe me, not you. Reacher looked away. DeWitt walked back to his desk and sat down. Is it possible Victor Hobie is still alive? Jody asked him. The distant helicopter shut off its engines. There was total silence. I have no comment on that, DeWitt said. Have you been asked that question before? Jody said. I have no comment on that, DeWitt said again. You saw the crash. Is it possible anybody survived it? I saw an explosion under the jungle canopy is all. He was way more than half full with fuel. Draw your own conclusion, Ms. Garber. Did he survive? I have no comment on that. Why is Kaplan officially dead and Hobie isn't? I have no comment on that. She nodded, thought for a moment and regrouped, exactly like the lawyer she was, boxed in by some recalcitrant witness. Just theoretically, then. Suppose a young man with Victor Hobie's personality and character and background survived such an incident, okay? Is it possible a man like that would never even have made contact with his own parents again afterward? DeWitt stood up again. He was clearly uncomfortable. I don't know, Miss Garber. I'm not a damn psychiatrist. And like I told you, I was careful not to get to know him too well. He seemed like a real dutiful guy, but he was cold. Overall, I guess I would rate it as very unlikely. But don't forget, Vietnam changed people. It sure as hell changed me, for instance. I used to be a nice guy. Officer Sark was 44 years old, but he looked older. His physique was damaged by a poor childhood and ignorant neglect through most of his adult years. His skin was dull and pale, and he had lost his hair early. It left him looking sallow and sunken and old before his time. But the truth was he had woken up to it and was fighting it. He had read stuff the NYPD's medical people were putting about concerning diet and exercise. He had eliminated most of the fats from his daily intake, and he'd started sunbathing a little, just enough to take the pallor off his skin without provoking the risk of melanomas. He walked whenever he could. Going home, he would get off the subway a stop short and hike the rest of the way, fast enough to get his breath going and his heartbeat raised, like the stuff he'd read said he should. And during the workday, he would persuade O'Hallinan to park the prowl car somewhere that would give them a short walk to wherever it was they were headed. O'Hallinan had no interest in aerobic exercise, but she was an amiable woman and happy enough to cooperate with him, especially during the summer months when the sun was shining. So she put the car against the curb in the shadow of Trinity Church, and they approached the World Trade Center on foot from the south. It gave them a brisk 600-yard walk in the sun, which made Sark happy. But it left the car exactly equidistant from a quarter of a million separate postal addresses, and with nothing on paper in the squad room, it left nobody with any clue about which one of them they were heading for. "You want to ride back to the airport?" DeWitt asked. Reacher interpreted the offer as a dismissal, mixed in with a gesture designed to soften the stonewall performance the guy had been putting up. He nodded. The Army Chevrolet would get them there faster than a taxi, because it was already waiting right outside with the motor running. "Thanks," he said. "Hey, my pleasure," DeWitt said back. He dialed a number from his desk and spoke like he was issuing an order. "Wait right here," he said. 3 minutes. Jody stood up and smoothed her dress down, walked to the windows and gazed out. Reacher stepped the other way and looked at the mementos on the wall. One of the photographs was a glossy reprint of a famous newspaper picture. A helicopter was lifting off from inside the embassy compound in Saigon, with a crowd of people underneath it, arms raised like they were trying to force it to come back down for them. "You were that pilot?" Reacher asked on a hunch. DeWitt glanced over and nodded. "You were still there in 75? DeWitt nodded again. 5 combat tours, then a spell on HQ duty. Overall, I guess I preferred the combat." There was noise in the distance, the base thumping of a powerful helicopter coming closer. Reacher joined Jody at the window. A Huey was in the air, drifting over the distant buildings from the direction of the field. "You're right," DeWitt said.
"A helicopter," Jody said.
DeWitt was smiling. "What did you expect? This is the helicopter school, after all. That's why these boys are down here. It ain't driver's ed." The rotor noise was building to a loud whop, whop, whop. Then it slowly blended to a higher-pitched whip, whip, whip as it came closer, and the jet whine mixed in. "Bigger blade now," DeWitt shouted. "Composite materials, not metal anymore. I don't know what old Vic would have made of it." The Huey was sliding sideways and hovering over the parade ground in front of the building. The noise was shaking the windows. Then the helicopter was straightening and settling to the ground. "Nice meeting you," DeWitt shouted. They shook his hand and headed out. The MP sergeant at the desk nodded to them through the noise and went back to his paperwork. They went down the stairs and outside into the blast of heat and dust and sound. The co-pilot was sliding the door for them. They ran bent over across the short distance. Jody was grinning and her hair was blowing everywhere. The co-pilot offered his hand and pulled her up inside. Reacher followed. They strapped themselves into the bench seat in the back, and the co-pilot slid the door closed and climbed through to the cabin. The familiar shudder of vibration started up as the craft hauled itself into the air. The floor tilted and swung, and the buildings rotated in the windows, and then their roofs were visible, and then the outlying grassland, with the highways laid through it like gray pencil lines. The nose went down, and the engine noise built to a roar as they swung on course and settled to a 100-mile-an-hour cruise. The stuff Sark had read called it power walking. And the idea was to push yourself towards a speed of 4 miles an hour. That way your heartbeat was raised, which was the key to the aerobic benefit, but you avoided the impact damage to your shins and knees that you risked with proper jogging. It was a convincing proposition, and he believed in it. Doing it properly, 600 yards at 4 miles an hour should have taken a fraction over 5 minutes, but it actually took nearer 8, because he was walking with O'Hallinan at his side.
She was happy to walk, but she wanted to do it slowly. She was not an unfit woman, but she always said, "I'm built for comfort, not for speed." It was a compromise. He needed her cooperation to get to walk at all, so he never complained about her pace. He figured it was better than nothing. It had to be doing him some kind of good. "Which building?" he asked. "The south, I think," she said. They walked around to the main entrance of the south tower and inside to the lobby. There were guys in security uniforms behind a counter, but they were tied up with a knot of foreign men in gray suits, so Sark and O'Hallinan stepped over to the building directory and consulted it direct. Cayman Corporate Trust was listed on the 88th floor. They walked to the express elevator and stepped inside without the security force being aware they had ever entered the building. The elevator floor pressed against their feet and sped them upward. It slowed and stopped at 88. The door slid back, and a muted bell sounded, and they stepped out into a plain corridor. The ceilings were low, and the space was narrow. Cayman Corporate Trust had a modern oak door with a small window and a brass handle. Sark pulled the door and allowed O'Hallinan to go inside ahead of him. She was old enough to appreciate the courtesy. There was an oak and brass reception area with a thick-set man in a dark suit behind a chest-high counter. Sark stood back in the center of the floor, his loaded belt emphasizing the width of his hips, making him seem large and commanding. O'Hallinan stepped up to the counter, planning her approach. She wanted to shake something loose, so she tried the sort of frontal attack she had seen detectives use. "We've come about Cheryl," she said. "I have to go home, I guess," Jody said. "No, you're coming to Hawaii with me." They were back inside the freezing terminal at Dallas-Fort Worth. The Huey had put down on a remote apron, and the co-pilot had driven them over in a golf cart painted dull green. He had shown them an unmarked door that led them up a flight of stairs into the bustle of the public areas. "Hawaii? Reacher, I can't go to Hawaii. I need to be back in New York." "You can't go back there alone. New York is where the danger is, remember? And I need to go to Hawaii, so you'll have to come with me. Simple as that." "Reacher, I can't," she said again. "I have to be in a meeting tomorrow. You know that. You took the call, right?" "Tough, Jody. You're not going back there alone." Checking out of the St. Louis honeymoon suite that morning had done something to him. The lizard part of his brain, buried deep behind the frontal lobes, had shrieked, "The honeymoon is over, pal. Your life is changing, and the problems start now." He had ignored it, but now he was paying attention to it. For the first time in his life, he had a hostage to fortune. He had somebody to worry about. It was mostly a pleasure, but it was also a burden. "I have to go back, Reacher," she said. "I can't let them down. Call them. Tell them you can't make it. Tell them you're sick or something." "I can't do that. My secretary knows I'm not sick, right? And I've got a career to think about. It's important to me." "You're not going back there alone," he said again. "Why do you need to go to Hawaii anyway?" "Because that's where the answer is," he said. He stepped away to a ticket counter and took a thick timetable from a small chrome rack, stood in the cold fluorescence and opened it up to D for the Dallas-Fort Worth departures, and ran his finger down the list of destinations as far as H for Honolulu. Then he flipped ahead to the Honolulu departures and checked the flights going back to New York. He double-checked, and then he smiled with relief. "We can make it anyway. Do both things. Look at this. There's a 12:15 out of here. Flight time minus the time change going west gets us to Honolulu at 3 o'clock. Then we get the 7 o'clock back to New York. Flight time plus the time change coming back east gets us into JFK at 12 noon tomorrow. Your guy said it was an afternoon meeting, right? So you can still make it." "I need to get briefed in," she said. "I have no idea what it's about." "You'll have a couple of hours. You're a quick study." "It's crazy. Only gives us 4 hours in Hawaii. All we need. I'll call ahead, set it up. We'll be on a plane all night." I'm going to my meeting after a sleepless night on a damn plane. So we'll go first class, he said. Rudder's paying, right? We can sleep in first class. The chairs look comfortable enough. She shrugged and sighed. Crazy. Let me use your phone, Reacher said. Jody handed him the mobile from her bag, and he called long-distance information and asked for the number. Dialed it, and heard it ring 6,000 miles away. It rang 8 times, and the voice he wanted to hear answered it. This is Jack Reacher, he said. Are you going to be in the office all day? The answer was slow and sleepy, because it was very early in the morning in Hawaii, but it was the answer he wanted to hear. He clicked the phone off and turned back to Jody. She sighed at him again, but this time there was a smile mixed in with it. She stepped to the counter and used the gold card to buy 2 first-class tickets, Dallas-Fort Worth to Honolulu to New York. The guy at the counter made the seat assignment on the spot, slightly bewildered in front of people paying the price of a used sports card to buy 20 hours on a plane and 4 on the ground on Oahu. He handed the wallets over, and 20 minutes later, Reacher was settling into an enormous leather and sheepskin chair, with Jody safely a yard away at his side.